Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. I'm here again with Russ Chianelli. And we're going to be talking today to someone who's interested in electrons. Electrons, you probably know, these are the building blocks that keep atoms together to form bonds. And bonding is very important. And most of us, you know, we take it for granted, but we don't look at electrons. This particular guest this week does. His name is Dennis Lichtenberger, professor of chemistry, University of Arizona, and he has the outstanding record of being on Science Studio about 22 years ago. So, Dennis, welcome back.
Good to be back.
And 22 years is a long time, so we don't have to worry about what you said last time.
Well, it's been an exciting 22 years, as a matter of fact. Science has come a long ways, and getting more exciting all the time, in my opinion.
Well, let's start off and remind our audience out there, how did you get into science?
Oh, well, it goes back as far as I can remember, which is actually before I even entered school. I grew up in the Midwest, but I always liked to explore, and I was always very curious about things. And my family said, well, okay, you can go out and explore, but don't leave the yard. And so I went out in the yard and saw everything that I could see in that yard and started looking closer and closer and smaller things. Watch how ants worked and the organization that they had and how all of this came together. And there was so much in that yard that I really never got tired of that, but I just kept looking closer and closer. And magnifying glass, and then I got a microscope, and that wasn't good enough. Saw the life at that level, went down lower, closer, and by the time I was in about the third grade, I had a chemistry set, and I was running experiments at that level trying to understand what was happening.
And
I remember—
In third grade, you were a chemistry set? I mean,
That's right, yeah.
And what I remember about that is, too, I did some pretty dangerous things. Did you do any dangerous things?
Yeah, I set off rockets. Small explosions and sparklers were a lot of fun. But I also had questions. For instance, I had a question about, you know, what does a fingerprint weigh or something like that. And my family was good. They weren't science-based at all, but they saw my curiosity. And so they bought me the microscope and the chemistry set. I built a bench. Chemistry bench, and then with my erector set, I built a balance so that I could weigh a fingerprint and set it up in a room and had some counterweights, and it actually worked, and found out what that weighed.
Well, so, how much does a fingerprint weigh? I mean, that's something that's been bothering me for years.
You know, I forget.
How sweaty you are, I guess, isn't it?
But I know it depends upon the size of the finger and what you ate that day.
That is actually a beautiful, I mean, the idea of doing the explosions. Was there a time when your parents said, okay, go do it in somebody else's yard?
They worried about that a bit, yeah. But no, we stayed pretty close to home, I guess, with that.
So, in fact, that's beautiful because you start from the big picture and you just honed in.
Just went right on down and eventually, I got to the point where as you mentioned, the electrons, the smallest element of a molecule, part of a molecule that holds it together, that drives its behavior, that controls the rest of the things that are happening, yeah. And that's where my curiosity has been since.
I tell all my students, I have a sophomore class, and it's called the periodic table, and I said, look, all you got to worry about is electrons. It's like in crime,
yes.
Follow the money. In chemistry, it's all about following the electrons.
That's right.
Nothing else really counts.
That's right.
That's a bit of an exaggeration.
Right.
You don't care about the nucleus?
Oh, no, not at all. That's for other people.
The nucleus will go where the electrons lead.
Yeah, so. Right, exactly. So anyway, tell us then, your career. I mean, just very briefly, where you started, how you finished up in Arizona.
Okay, well, at that time, when I had the curiosity about how electrons were controlling behavior, people thought of that as just being theoretical. And so I went into computations and programming. I wrote programs that would display the models that we have for electron distributions in molecules and their energies and things like that. I went into a group. We looked like a bunch of accountants sitting in a room with pencils and papers doing our theory on the way these electrons moved. But I got itchy because I still enjoyed building things and seeing things. I really wanted to see them. And like the instrument I built to weigh a fingerprint, I was thinking about instruments that I could think about to actually measure electrons and their energies and see their behavior. The group I was in was not an experimental group, didn't have instrumentation, so I would build instruments on the side in a way.
This was in graduate school or is this?
This is in graduate school now, yeah. Where? Yeah, and about that time, a technique became developed called photoelectron spectroscopy that has led to some Nobel Prizes in the area, as a matter of fact. The technique is based upon the Einstein photoelectric effect, which is actually the reason that he won the Nobel Prize. It wasn't for the theory of relativity. It was for his explaining the behavior of electrons interacting with light. And that's the whole basis of the technique, is you shine light on the molecule, you move the electrons, and you measure their movement. So in conceptually, it's actually quite simple.
And do you have to do that in a solid phase, gas phase? I mean, it's easier in the gas phase, I presume.
You can get a more detailed look at the molecules in the gas phase because they're a single molecule not interacting with others, not being changed at the same time. So you get a very high resolution, high energy look at the electrons. But you can do it on solids and liquids, any form of matter. You can get some information. You just get the best information when you have a gas phase molecule.
Okay. Why don't you describe how to do the measurement a little bit for our fans out there that want to do this in their garage?
Okay. You could build this in your garage. You need a light source first to excite the electrons. You can use a fluorescent light has the right energy in it, except there's a fluorescent filter on there that filters out the most energetic light. So the basis of a fluorescent light is the basis of our light source. You just shine that light on the molecule. It has enough energy. You feel heat from the light, but this is a higher energy that actually moves the electrons away from the molecule. And they come out with a certain speed depending upon the energy of the light and how tightly they were held in the molecule. And the more tightly they're held in the molecule, the slower they come out. They come out with a slower speed left over. So then what we do is we just measure that speed of the electron.
And how do you do that?
Well, the electron has a negative charge on it, and it has a mass, and it's moving. So you put it between plates that are – one plate's negatively charged, so the electron's going to be repelled away from that plate. And on the other plate is a positive charge that it's attracted to. And if it's going really fast, it's not curved. It doesn't curve very much between those charges. But if it's going slow, it curves a lot. And by measuring the curvature of the electron, essentially, where it finally hits a detector.
I mean, you point it as if it's going to go straight.
Yes.
But then it gets offset.
Yeah, and
then
you curve it off.
In relation to the speed.
And the amount it curves off is what you measure. Yeah.
And so that tells you something about the energy of the electron, how tightly it was bound.
Yeah, so you trace that back to how tightly it was held in the molecule. If it's in a very strong bond, it's hard to get that electron out. If it's held very close to a nucleus of the atom, it's hard to get out. But if it's in a reactive state, up in a what we call a lone pair electron that's easy to remove, that's going to react with other molecules, the most reactive electrons come out the fastest, and they're the ones that we're most interested in.
Okay, because that's the easiest one. That would be called the first ionization energy.
First ionization energy, yeah.
So you've been working on this for a long time. I mean,
yeah.
You've got a reputation around the world. I mean, I will say, oh, yeah, Dennis Lichtenberger, I know him. I met him once 22 years ago in Science Studio. Although you did run some samples for us. I don't know if you remember that, some transition metal silicon compounds. But what's the most exciting result that you've had to date? If you could sort of try to translate the excitement that you felt from a particular result using your technique with molecules that you were either collaborating with or made for yourself.
Well, there's several. And every few years, there's a tremendous surprise that comes out of being able to see things that people haven't seen before. And one of them I can mention was 22 years ago with C60, the Buckminster fullerene. A lot of people had predicted what the electron levels in that would be, but no one had enough sample to be able to measure it until that time, which was actually first made in bulk at the University of Arizona. And so I was in the right place at the right time with the right equipment and ran a quick experiment.
When you say bulk, I mean, what did you have, 2 grams or?
Tenth of a gram.
A tenth of a gram.
Yeah.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah, quite a bit. You could have a vial full of it, a black crystalline solid that was quite surprising.
Because they were making them in these laser devices or something, right?
Yeah. Rick Smalley at Rice was the first person to observe the molecule, but he did it by a laser ablation process. It was very destructive, and he happened to see very stable mass of carbon coming off
pieces,
the sample.
Yeah.
This is amazing to me, is that there was one line in a spectrum, one sharp line at one particular mass. And from that, he deduced that for something to be that stable at that mass, it had to have the round structure of a Buckminster fullerene type species.
So what did you learn then? What was the exciting point about
the
result?
Okay, so this is a big molecule. It has a lot of electrons that are easy to remove. And that's one reason people were interested in that, because the applications you can make of that. And usually there's only two electrons in the top level of a molecule. Sometimes in very special cases you can get six. This molecule has 10 in the top level because of the symmetry. Even though it has 60 carbon atoms, its electronic behavior is like that of a small molecule, but with lots of electrons. And so with our experiment, we were able to measure that, and we saw that coming out of that, instead of a large number of energies for the electrons, they came out in just very narrow areas, like a small molecule. And when we saw this, I remember the staff person in the lab had never seen anything like this. He was dancing in the lab. This is a person you would never imagine to be dancing to see something like this. When I came here 22 years ago, we had not yet published the paper on what we had seen. And after I got that paper out, I wrote it on my kitchen table on a Sunday afternoon, one of the easiest papers I've ever had to write, sent it out, put it out in the literature, and went back to work. And sometime later, I got a call pointing out that people were citing this paper all over the world. It turned out to be the 13th most cited paper in all the sciences that
wow.
year. And it was not just from chemists or even physicists, but materials scientists and optical scientists and all of the different areas where this could have an application. So that was quite a lot of fun.
I actually remember when you were on the program, you made some rather bold predictions about the utility of this C60.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Look back over this 22-year period. Have those predictions, not the particulars of them, but the general tremendous interest in these buckyballs.
Yes.
What do you see?
Yeah, well, they've been investigated and applied in a number of different areas. Companies went into the business of selling it.
Yes.
And then people were incorporating them into things like solar cells, because you want to move electrons by the light, again, in a solar cell. And these have electrons at energy levels that can adjust the energy levels so that the electrons move more easily in the solar cells. So it's both the occupied levels and the holes that it can accept electrons that allow it to do that. The surprising thing then that came shortly after that was not only that discovery, but then that led into what are called nanorods, which are tubular forms of carbon, like rolled up graphite, that then also have applications for electron transfer and possible uses in computers and other kinds of things.
Tell us a little bit more about these 10 electrons. They're up there, they're non-bonding, and they're just sitting there waiting for some physicist to apply them.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we're provided a material and with a new property that then opens up a world of other possibilities for these kinds of things.
You're listening to Science Studio. Our guest is Dennis Lichtenberger. My name is Keith Pannell, here with co-host Russ Chianelli, talking about this buckyballs that were just on the horizon of the scientific interest when Dennis was first on Science Studio 22 years ago. We'll be back in a minute.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Once I called my wife from the grocery store to ask why I was there. So embarrassing to have these senior moments.
I'm lucky to remember to shave in the morning. A new study points to something called brain microbleeds, or BMB, for contributing to our mental decline. It's caused by stiff arteries, in particular the aorta.
The aorta is the body's largest blood vessel and feeds blood to the brain. It's flexible in order to smooth out blood flow to the brain. However, as we age, the aorta hardens, which increases the blood pressure there.
That pressure can be strong enough to rupture small blood vessels, which leads to BMB. These small areas of blood vessel bursts kill brain cells, which can be seen on MRIs.
About 5% of adults have BMB, and it jumps to nearly 34% in people who've had strokes from blood clots. It's also associated with hypertension, diabetes, and some scientists believe it contributes to Alzheimer's disease.
The stiffness of the aorta is measured by taking our central blood pressure, which is different from traditional blood pressure taken at the arm. The central blood pressure is the difference between the pressure wave of the blood coming from the heart and the reflected pressure from the blood vessels farthest from the heart. The higher the number, the stiffer the aorta.
Researchers measured the aortic stiffness of 500 people aged 20 to 82 and tested their cognitive abilities. The higher the central blood pressure, the worse people tended to perform on visual processing and memory.
Establishing that aortic stiffening is responsible for BMB, researchers would need to follow these same volunteers for many years. If the connection is made, then the hunt will be on to preserve the elasticity of the aorta and prevent brain microbleeds.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Dennis Lichtenberger from the University of Arizona talking about his entry into chemistry, science, materials. Can we get onto the hydrogen economy now? Because I know that's what you're sort of doing right now.
Yeah.
The buckyballs is the history that's in the past. But now, you know, all scientists have got a history, and they've got a present, and they've got a future.
So people have talked about the hydrogen economy. We need hydrogen. As a matter of fact, it is already a $100 billion a year industry in the production of hydrogen. And in fact, a lot of that industry is right here in Texas, as a matter of fact. And what it's used for in this is not driving cars so much. What most of it is used for is taking nitrogen from the air and adding hydrogen to it to make ammonia, which then makes a fertilizer. And there's quite a system of here in Texas on the coast making hydrogen for reducing nitrogen to ammonia, and then shipping that to the Midwest and other areas for fertilizing plants. And there's been a prediction if that process were stopped today, a substantial percentage of the world population would starve within a year because there just would not be enough food to feed everyone on the earth.
You mean the actual production here in Texas or worldwide?
In Texas for this country, but it's done elsewhere in the world as well. So how is hydrogen made today? And scientifically, the first way you would think about it would be to do electrolysis, to have a cell that you run electricity into so that you're putting those electrons on the protons to make the hydrogen molecule. And electrolysis was the original way to do it. The best material for doing that is actually platinum, but platinum is too expensive. It's $4,000 to $5,000 a kilogram for platinum, and there's not enough in the world to do all the process that we need.
I mean, this is platinum as an electrode.
As an electrode,
right?
Yeah.
Which you would think then, well, electrodes should last forever, but clearly they don't. Otherwise, you could just make all the platinum electrodes, and that would be it for the rest of all time.
Except you still couldn't make enough of them for the future need that we're going to have. There just isn't enough platinum, and there's better uses for platinum as well. So there's many uses for that. So it turns out that right now the most cost-effective way to do it is to superheat steam and operate that on oil and petroleum. So actually oil and petroleum are our sources of hydrogen as well. There's a couple of problems. There's better things to use oil and petroleum for than making hydrogen. And the other thing about the process is that you also make carbon monoxide, which is a poison. That's a byproduct of this. It's called a steam reforming process on petroleum. And so you have to do something with that carbon monoxide. Well, the other interesting thing about having hydrogen is that you can use it to hydrogenate, if you want to say it that way, carbon dioxide. You can use it to make carbon dioxide into methanol and liquid fuels as well, so you can get multiple uses out of it now. So, but obviously the cost of it is still a big deterrent for what we need to do. We need better catalysts. Platinum is a catalyst in the process. We need better catalysts, cheaper, that are made out of more available elements from the periodic table that are cheaper and run well. So that's where our research is going right now.
But how does the technique that you're well known for, photoelectron spectroscopy, fit into that? Because I could imagine many people who know nothing about photoelectron spectroscopy are looking at this same particular problem. So
that's
what's your particular angle?
Well, like I said earlier, the key to understanding the chemistry at the lowest level is to understand how you're moving the electrons. To make hydrogen, we have sources of hydrogen atoms in water, for instance, but it's not in the form of a hydrogen molecule, which is H2, which is what we really want. To get it from the form that it is in water to H2, the hydrogen molecule, we need to add electrons to it. There has to be a mechanism for doing that, to transfer that electron to do that. And so that's where we're looking at that. So the energy process that it takes, you have to put energy in to get energy out. We're measuring the energy levels that you put in and that you get out on these systems by photoelectron spectroscopy. We measure the energy of the electrons that are involved in the process.
Give us an example of one experimental setup with the molecules that you're looking at, and so that I can get a feeling for it.
Okay, so some of the types of catalysts that we look at are actually inspired by nature. Nature's figured out how to do this process quite well.
Nitrogenase.
Hydrogenase is the key example. And in the center of that hydrogenase enzyme is a metal complex, actually an organometallic complex with iron. Some of them have iron and nickel. Iron is very abundant. Sulfur is very abundant. That forms the main catalytic core that's taking place there. And then there's other molecules like carbon monoxide and cyanide in there, which is quite surprising in a living species also. But nature's really very good at this. And I've set this up so that one mole of enzyme, if you know, this is a measure of quantity of the enzyme, can produce enough hydrogen in 10 minutes to fill a hot air balloon. If you could get the starting materials in and the hydrogen out fast enough, that's how fast the rate is right at the center of that enzyme. So we're taking that and trying to understand how the enzyme is doing. The problem is the enzyme, we could grow it, but it's too expensive to grow it and use it entirely as a source. We want to get down to the essential internal side of that and just focus on that and make that work for us. So we make that molecule.
Which is ferredoxin or something?
It's a di-iron, disulfur molecule, yeah. We put structures around it somewhat similar to the enzyme, but not exactly.
It's like a cube.
It's not exactly a cube in this case.
But close.
Actually, the enzyme has cubes in it that transfer the electrons, so the irons and the sulfurs are really doing a lot of work here. Yeah, so we make something very similar to what's inside the enzyme to try to understand how the enzyme is controlling those energy levels in that system, and we'll measure the electron energy levels. We'll take electrons in, put electrons out. We have made samples that actually do the catalysis. We can actually put them in a solvent and put the electrons in. They end up on the hydrogen, and we see the hydrogen molecules bubbling out of the solution on these systems.
There's a lot of people working on this. And my first career position where I could say I had a job, all right, was in a unit of nitrogen fixation at the University of Sussex in England.
Okay.
And that's been going for 50 years.
Yeah.
And yet we don't really – we've made all sorts of progress. We've made all sorts of nice molecules where we can see dinitrogen bonded at metals and you can reduce it to various forms, including ammonia. But what's the big stumbling block? I mean, why is it with all this effort – I mean, it's like the war on cancer, except that's a much more complicated issue – what is it that's the real stumbling block to being able to do what nature does with nitrogenase so readily after 50 years of intense research, not only in England, but the USA,
nobody's
Russia.
Got the molecule to turn over very easily in solution.
Well, that's true. There are some high rates, but you have to put in too much energy. And if you cut the energy level back that you're putting in, then you don't get a high enough rate. And it seems to be a catch-22 kind of situation in what we're working on right now. The enzymes have a number of advantages. They have a head start on us in engineering these systems. If we're making a highly reducing species, we want to keep oxygen out. Enzymes have figured out ways to do that. They have figured out ways to shut off side reactions taking place by capturing the active site inside the enzyme and keeping it from doing anything other than what they want it to do. And we haven't yet engineered a molecule that will do both of those kinds of things.
Well, let me ask you this, because you said we were talking about before, something I'm working on too that we could talk about, is that you had in your mind to replace noble metals.
Right.
Now, this is something I'm working on too, and we have a particular way of doing that we call Goldilocks, by the way. I'll explain that some other time. What's your philosophy? What in the chemistry is going to change that mimics the noble metal?
Well, again, it's the electronic structure that you're going after and the potentials, the energies of the electrons in there. The noble metals have some particular advantages in some of those ways, but there isn't any real reason that we can't change and tune the structure around almost any of the metals that we want to go in these directions in principle. That's the basic answer. Some of the noble metals, we still don't know how they're operating either. Certainly the platinum electrode itself is a very complex system that we don't know structurally how it's doing what it's doing. And it's very hard to learn that because of we don't have the instrumentation and tools right now to really understand that.
Well, I know if you go back to Dr. John Sinfeld, who won the Presidential Medal for doing noble metal hydrogenolysis, he attributed noble metal activities to be due to the 4 and 5D electrons, non-bonding electrons that were available for the reaction. And so in my idea was that, you know, you want to mimic that kind of electronic structure by doing combinations.
That's exactly right, yeah. And that's what we look at by the technique is we can see by the photoelectron spectroscopy what our electron configuration is and learn a little bit more about how to adjust it in the direction that we want to go in on that. So that's the good thing we have. We didn't have that tool before. We have tools now that we didn't have before so that we can help guide the research in the directions that we want to go.
So the work that you're doing sounds like it should be this famous catchwork, interdisciplinary, because you need people who have got knowledge of the nitrogenase, for example.
Right.
And so you've got to have people who understand biochemistry. You've got to understand people who understand instrumentation, synthesis. So how do you function as a group?
That's really interesting because when I started in science, there was a feeling that you shouldn't collaborate because people wouldn't be able to identify what your contribution is. But I've always been a very collaborative type and enjoyed working with other people. And that's where I think you can get the best science done, is bringing in all the talents and tools around. Even in my research group, I have physical chemists, analytical chemists, organic chemists, a wide range of people. We interact with a number of people in other departments and all around the world. We're part of a program called Collaborative Research in Chemistry that brings all these talents together. So
you mean that's something specific to Arizona, or is this some national?
This was a program set up by National Science Foundation. It's been changed into different forms over the years, but.
So anyway, this is part of an NSF. So NSF, the funding agency in North America, recognizes this need for the collaborative
very
research.
Very much, and right. as you said, this is not just in North America. This is all over the world. Right now, people are looking at this in many, many different ways.
Right.
It's recognized as one of the grand challenges in science for the future. And I think it's an area in which chemistry in particular is going to have a very large impact.
Well, Dennis Lichtenberger, you don't look any a day older than I remember you looking last time. That's because my memory is going as I'm 22 years older. Thank you very much for being back here with us on Science Studio.
Enjoyed
Fascinating
it.
Program.
Yes, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
So next week, there'll be another Science Studio. We hope you're out there. Without you, there is no us. So take care, and we'll see you next week.
Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The American Psychological Foundation is accepting grant applications for $12,000, which will be awarded to an early career psychologist working to address a critical psychological need in an underserved population. Deadline to submit an application is December 31st. Learn more at mcasynapse.org.